It is a pervasive assumption in many studies of orality and literacy that there is a great divide between cultures in which knowledge is transmitted orally and those in which knowledge is transmitted in writing. While the exact nature of this divide remains disputed, and theories range from the extreme end of the continuum, where writing is assumed to effect a radical cognitive transformation that makes scientific reasoning possible for the first time, to the more negative view already proposed by Plato in antiquity, that writing erodes the human capacity to remember. Writing and orality are conceived to be two completely separate and in many ways mutually exclusive technologies that communicate knowledge in fundamentally different ways with greater or lesser degrees of effectiveness. To cite only one of very many examples, Walter Ong, the media theorist and one of the pioneers in the study of orality, wrote in his classic work on the subject of oral culture, Orality and Literacy, writing, commitment of the word to space enlarges the potentiality of language almost beyond measure, restructures thought, and in the process converts a few dialects into graphilects. A graphilect is a trans-dialectical language formed by deep commitment to writing. Writing gives a graphilect a power far exceeding that of any purely oral dialect. The graphilect, known as Standard English, has accessible for use a recorded vocabulary of at least 1.5 million words, of which not only the present meanings, but also hundreds of thousands of past meanings are known. A simply oral dialect will commonly have resources of only a few thousand words, and its users will have virtually no knowledge of the real semantic history of any of these words." End quote. Or, to cite another example pertaining more directly to the ancient world, the renowned Assyriologist and historian of writing, I.J. Gelb, wrote in his groundbreaking A Study of Writing in 1952, "This sequence of the stages of writing, from logographic to phonetic to alphabetic writing systems, reflects the stages of primitive psychology. Naturally, as all primitives can grasp parts of speech, such as utterances and phrases, it is frequently with some difficulty that they can recognize individual words. The ability to divide a word into its component syllables is a great step in their understanding of speech, and it frequently must be learned through outside influence. The division of syllables into single sounds usually lies beyond their capacity. That the sequence in analyzing speech is the most natural one is supported by the fact that almost all writings introduced in modern times among primitive societies stopped at the syllabic stage." End quote. While these are admittedly not the most nuanced examples, and comparing cultures without writing to children and people with language development disorders must be understood in the context of the neo-evolutionary models that once dominated the study of pre-industrial societies, the assumption of an unbridgeable divide between orality and literacy continues to have a profound influence on how oral and written modes of communication are characterized and understood. Note, for example, the implicit understanding of orality as a separate and fundamentally distinct process from writing that informs the two following statements about the relationship between the oral and written transmission of Sumerian literature, both of which were made in the past 20 to 30 years by Assyriologists who have greatly advanced our understanding of the interface of orality and literacy in ancient Mesopotamia through their groundbreaking work on the subject. In a volume devoted to the topic of whether Mesopotamian epic literature is oral or oral, Gerald Cooper, in his inimitable tongue-in-cheek style, observed, "Indeed, it is tautological to claim that a given literature was oral before it was written. Would anyone deny that in mid-fourth millennium Sumer elite bureaucrats, tired after a long day of administering multi-leveled redistributed organizations with their heavy, ornately carved seals and clumsy token-filled bulle, sought diversion by listening to highly specialized bards whose songs drew on a rich oral tradition? Or that homesick Sumerian trader colonists at Hububu Kabira in Syria slake their melancholy by telling traditional tales of their distant motherland, fondling their beveled drum bowls to tactilely augment the oral reminder of people and places left behind? Similarly, as has been repeatedly pointed out by others, actual Mesopotamian oral literature is what, by definition, we can never have. Even the most accurate ancient transcription of the performance of a hypothetical Mesopotamian bard would, by virtue of the process of transcription and the decontextualized artifact that was its end product, be something very different than a work of oral literature. Or, in a similar vein, writing specifically about the influence the oral version of the Sumerian literary composition Gilgamesh and Aga might have had on the written transmission of the same text, Miguel Seville noted, "The existence side by side of a long living version and a short written one would create a constant feeding and counterfeeding of textual variants. Without getting into details, it is easy to see how this could complicate in unexpected and undetectable ways the genealogy of manuscripts." Turning then to the question posed by the organizers of this conference, what influence have these views of the relationship between orality and writing had on the way oral transmission is conceived to have affected the redaction of Mesopotamian literary compositions? Although differing significantly in the effects they claim writing has on the content of texts, and in the extent to which orality and literacy are thought to interact in any particular time and place, what all of these positions have in common is the implicit assertion that the effects of oral transmission on written texts are essentially unknowable. In its most rigid form, the view that orality belongs to an earlier stage in the development of societies cannot be applied at all to ancient Mesopotamia, which possessed writing. Unless, of course, it is assumed that only the allegedly small percentage of elites that could read and write had benefited from the cognitive transformations stimulated by writing, in which case it would still be necessary to conclude that nothing can be known about how knowledge circulated orally among the vast majority of the largely illiterate population. Similarly, even in the substantially more nuanced positions of Cooper and Seville, which take into full account the complex ways in which the oral and the written can interact to complicate how messages are transmitted in societies like Mesopotamia, where orality and literacy are mixed, the influence of orality still remains unexplained. But is it really the case that nothing can be known about the effects of orality on written texts? Is the divide between orality and writing really so vast that, in contrast to writing, which produces identifiable evidence of its effects everywhere it is introduced, orality leaves no lasting and decipherable traces of its presence? What if writing was not always the agent of redactional change and was instead sometimes put in the service of oral communication, so that in these cases it was orality more than writing that shaped the written version of a text? In the remainder of this paper, I would like to consider this possibility more seriously and argue that the corpus of Sumerian laments provides at least one clear instance of a group of texts whose written form was largely influenced by the needs of oral performance. To demonstrate this, I will give examples of how the earliest known written sources for the laments provide evidence that these compositions were put in writing to aid in performing the works orally and not simply to ensure their written transmission. In ancient Mesopotamia, lamenting belonged to a set of cultural practices which were used to prevent or remove individual and collective misfortune. Although lamenting was probably performed in many different ways, in many different types of rituals, one particularly well-attested form of ritual lamenting involved the singing or recitation of Sumerian cultic laments known as balags and arshemas. Many of these compositions concern the destruction of cities and the abandonment of temples in the wake of destructive gods like Enlil, Inanna, Ishkur, and others turning in rage against them, but there are also numerous laments which pertain to the separation of Inanna from her lover Dumuzi when he is carried away by demons to the netherworld, or a similar deity Damu, who also disappears and is mourned by his family. Lamenting as a cultic practice becomes increasingly more important at the beginning of the second millennium BCE, during the period known as the Old Babylonian period, when the two main types of laments, balags and arshemas, were first put into writing. At present, there are approximately 475 Old Babylonian copies of Sumerian laments that are known. Over half of these sources are from cities in northern Mesopotamia, including Kish and Sippar, but the existence of over 70 copies of laments from the same period from Nippur and additional groups of sources from other southern Mesopotamian cities like Girsu and Larsa is a clear indication that laments were copied throughout Mesopotamia during this period. Although many of the same laments that were first put in writing during the Old Babylonian period continued to be copied in extended and modified form well into the first millennium, in contrast to the versions of the laments from later periods, which had assumed a more or less fixed written form, the copies of laments from the early second millennium are characterized by extreme variability in their content and form. Since the process by which Sumerian laments were transmitted appears to have changed by the first millennium, when the written transmission of the text was no longer as strongly influenced by the needs of oral performance, only examples from Old Babylonian sources will be considered, and any conclusions that can be drawn from them are intended to apply only to laments from this period. There's little question that Sumerian laments known from written sources were actively performed in cultic rituals. It is clear from letters, descriptions of rituals, statements of when specific laments were to be performed, and many other sources of evidence that laments were performed regularly during the first millennium as an integral part of nearly every cultic ritual that is known from that time. But it is no less evident that laments were also performed regularly in earlier periods as well, as indicated by evidence such as references to the performance of laments in administrative sources from both the late third and early second millennium, and the inclusion of lamenting in the building ritual described in the cylinders of Gudea, a ruler of Lagash at the end of the third millennium. The most direct evidence for the performance of Sumerian laments during the Old Babylonian period, however, is in the description of a ritual to the goddess Ishtar, described in a tablet from the city of Mari on the Middle Euphrates, dating to the reign of the ruler Yasma'adu, who ruled near the beginning of the 18th century BCE, which contains references to the performance of individual sections of the lament, Uru Ama Irabi, at different moments in the ritual, referring to these sections by the same incipits that occur at the beginning of the corresponding sections in the written version of the composition. So here on the slide, you have an excerpt from this ritual description of, from Mari of the Ishtar ritual, with an excerpt in which you get an example of an incipit, the first line of one of the sections of Uru Ama Irabi being cited in connection with a ritual action that was performed during this ritual. So, if it is certain that Sumerian laments were copied to be performed, what was the relationship between the oral versions of the laments that were performed and the written copies of the same laments, and what influence, if any, might the use of laments in performance have had on the content and form of the written versions of these compositions? There are at least two strong indications that the written copies of Sumerian laments were compiled primarily for the purpose of aiding in oral performance. The first is the relatively large number of copies of laments which are written phonetically instead of in the conventional orthography for the MSL dialect of Sumerian, the register of Sumerian in which all laments were composed. And here is an example of what we mean by phonetic writings. So in the bottom, in the source A, you have the conventional writing, tur, tur. For example, the sign, cuneiform sign with the reading tur. And in the line above it, you have a source that writes the same signs phonetically, sort of spelling out each of the parts as tu, tu, ur, instead of using tur, tur. So there are some examples of these type of writings. Nearly half of the Old Babylonian copies of laments that are currently known are written in a highly phonetic orthography, like the orthography in the first lines on the slide there. There are five main types of phonetic writings that occur in these sources. One of them, you know, examples of each of these five types are listed here. You have homophonous signs, when you use another sign other than the one that's conventionally used to write a word or a sound in the language, like asha, using the sha one sign instead of asha three in the word for field, which is always written with the sha three sign and never with sha. Or mu mu, to write the verb mu tu, which means to grow, using the sign that sounds like the way the verb would have been pronounced, but was not the cuneiform sign that was typically used to render that verb in, with the writing system. In addition to homophonous signs, you also have polysyllabic words written with multiple signs, and here are some examples. Sukud, which means to be high, to stretch from the earth to the heaven, for example, you see written in phonetic source with sukuda instead of with the single sign that was pronounced sukud. Another type of phonetic writing is when the consonant reduplication at the end of a word is avoided. So instead of writing hula for to destroy, you have hula without the L at the end of the verb, dima for dimma, etc. Sandi writings are another type of phonetic writing you find in these sources where they merge the word boundaries. So instead of dubur ana, you have dubur rana, etc. And the other type of phonetic writing that you find in this source is the omission of determinatives that are usually marking the class to which a word or a noun belongs. In this case, the divine determinative dinger is omitted with the god Dumuzi, etc. Yeah. These five types of phonetic writings reveal a consistent tendency to make clearer the pronunciation of the words in the lament by using signs to write each syllable in a polysyllabic word, or sandi writings to indicate the pronunciation of a sequence of forms, and by using homophonous signs or omitting determinatives and reduplicated consonants to eliminate any ambiguities in pronunciation introduced by the orthographic complexity of the script. Since many of the laments that were copied phonetically would have also been performed, it seems very likely that the phonetic writings in these sources were intended to aid in the performance of the compositions by making it easier for the performer to recognize how the words in the text were to be pronounced when sung or recited. The second indication that the written copies of Sumerian laments had a performative function is the extreme variability in the content of the sources for individual laments, on the one hand, and the recurrence of the same passages in identical or modified forms in multiple laments on the other. To cite only a few examples of these two tendencies, there are three old Babylonian sources with the beginning of the Balag Uru'ama Irabi, two of which are from Kish, and one of which is probably from Uruk. But even though these sources clearly contain the same composition, every line of each source contains multiple instances of orthographic, grammatical, and semantic forms that do not occur in the corresponding lines of the other two sources. And here are just a few examples of some of the differences, the variants you find between the two sources. Some of the more notable ones, for example, in the second example on the slide, are the addition of two lines in the source from Uruk that aren't found in the two sources from Kish that indicate the name of a part of Uruk in the litany at the beginning of the text, which makes sense given the provenience of the tablet, assuming that the text was compiled for the cultic needs of the city of Uruk as opposed to Kish. It would make sense that they would make references in the text to temples and parts of the city where the lament would have been performed. Other examples you can find here on the slide, phonetic writings in one of the sources from Kish, the changing of one of the epithets of Inanna from her title, the Lady of the Eanna, which is a shrine at Uruk, to the title, the Lady of the Horsag Kalama, which is the name of the temple of Inanna at the city of Kish, which is where the source that has that variant is from, right? Additionally, there is a sequence of five epithets of Inanna which occurs with very little variation in no less than 16 different laments. This is one example of the standard litany with a list of some of the other texts in which the same or a similar litany occurs. And a passage describing the separation of the ewe and goat from their lamb and kid that occurs with minor variation in at least 21 different laments, including, but not limited to, Ershemas and Balags, to Inanna, Dumuzi, Enlil, and the goddess Ninhorsag. As is well known from the study of oral literature and other cultural traditions, the recurrence of repeated formulae and significant variability in the content of the same composition each time it is performed are two of the most distinguishing features of oral poetry. In addition to the phonetic writings and copies of laments, the variability in the written versions of the same balags and ershemas, and the repetition of identical or nearly identical passages in multiple compositions, however, Clear evidence that the written sources for laments were compiled to aid in oral performance can also be found in the individual sources for these texts. One particularly decisive example is a pair of sources in the collection of the Vorderasiatisches Museum in Berlin that contains a nearly identical passage from a text that is identified as an Erschema to Inanna in one of the additional duplicates of the same composition. So here you have the two sources from Sipar with the same text. What is of particular interest in these two copies, which are probably from Sipar, is that one of the two sources, the source on the left, VAT 1419, contains only the first 3 to 4 lines in each of the lines that are written in their full form in the other source. So you can see in the blank space in the tablet to the left that the scribe omitted the second half of all the lines and wrote only the beginning of each of the lines. And in the source next to it, which has the same text, they've written out the full line and they haven't omitted the ends like they have in the other source. Moreover, in contrast to the other source, which is written in conventional MSL orthography, the words and phrases in the abbreviated source are written in the same highly phonetic orthography found in other copies of Sumerian laments that was used to make the words and forms in the composition easier for the performer to recite or sing. And here are some examples of the way in which in the abbreviated source, the scribe has written out the words and phrases, the way they were pronounced as opposed to the way they were usually written. So you see ga am with the am 1 sign and the do 1 sign for rendering ga am 3, do 11. Do 11 is the verb for to speak, which is always written with that sign and never with the do sign, for example. It therefore seems very likely that the source was intended to serve as a mnemonic aid for the performer who would presumably have known the composition by memory and would have been able to remember the content more easily simply by seeing the first word or phrase in each line. Moreover, since mnemonic cues function more effectively when they are heard as opposed to seen, just think of the last time you forgot the words in the middle of a song and you were put back on track by somebody telling you the beginning of the line you had forgotten, enabling you to remember the rest of the song again. Using phonetic writings to activate the pronunciation of the beginning of each line would have made this copy a particularly effective aid in helping the performer remember the lament. If then, the content of many, if not all, the copies of Sumerian laments dating to the early second millennium were influenced and shaped by the needs of oral performance, what implications does this have for understanding the process of redacting and editing the written versions of these texts? While it is clear that by the first millennium, the laments had assumed a more or less fixed written form, the relationship between the oral and written versions of Sumerian laments appears to have been completely different during the Old Babylonian period. Since the content of the oral versions of Sumerian laments was more fluid during this earlier period, so that each time a particular lament was performed, a certain set of recurrent lines, passages, and themes remained the same, but the rest of the composition was subject to constant modification and variation, it would be futile to try to reconstruct the redactional histories of the laments from the written sources for the compositions, if for no other reason than that the content of the laments had not yet been fixed in writing. In fact, in contrast to the usual understanding of the relationship between orality and writing, it is orality and not writing that appears to have shaped the content of the laments at this stage in their transmission, with the existing written sources reflecting different aspects of the oral transmission of the laments, while revealing little or nothing about the effect of writing on the transmission process. Though not every written tradition was preceded by a stage in which the written versions of the compositions were in a state of constant flux due to the effects of oral transmission, the early written sources for the Sumerian laments should serve as a cautious reminder to scholars studying the textual transmission of the Bible and other text corpora from the ancient Near East that the oldest surviving copies of a composition are not always more accurate reflections of the original version of the text, especially when the composition did not become fixed in writing until a much later period. But this is a topic for another paper. Thank you.